the Old West and the New, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with Jane Tompkins, a professor of English at Duke University. We'll talk about her new book, West of Everything. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated.
Amazing man ever to ride the prairies of the early West. Hopalong Cassidy, the same Hoppy you cheer in motion pictures, and the same California you've laughed at a million times. Raw courage and quick shooting have built a legend around this famous hero. Hopalong is a name to be feared, respected, and admired, for this great cowboy rides the trails of adventure and excitement. William Boyd as Hopalong Cassidy, and Andy Clyde as California. What's our story this time, Hoppy?
We call this one the Killers of Lion Canyon. California and I were riding in the Skeleton Mountains. That's a range not far west of the Bar 20.
I used to keep a photograph of the young John Wayne posted on my bulletin board. He has on a cowboy hat, and he is even then developing a little of that inimitable cowboy squint so beloved of millions. But he has not yet gotten the cowboy face, the leathery wall of non-communication written over by wrinkles, speaking pain and hardship and the refusal to give in to them, speaking the determination to tough it out against all odds, speaking the willingness to be cruel in return for cruelty, and letting you know, beyond all shadow of a doubt, who's boss.
Jane Tompkins teaches at Duke University. Her latest book is West of Everything, published by Oxford University Press. West of Everything presents what Tompkins calls the inner life of Westerns and provides a new reading of old themes and landscapes in the American West. In her book, Tompkins presents what she terms the elements of the Western, including barren landscapes and a preoccupation with death and pain in the lives of hard-bitten men and marginalized women, a preoccupation that amounts to a code of behavior. For better or worse, according to Jane Tompkins, Westerns have had a profound impact on our contemporary emotional lives and taught us, especially men, how to behave. I asked Jane Tompkins to read from her new book and to describe where she locates the beginnings of Western novels and films.
My answer to the question of why the Western takes place in the West is that the West was a place where technology was primitive, physical conditions harsh, the social infrastructure non-existent, and the power and presence of women proportionately reduced. The Western doesn't have anything to do with the West as such. It isn't about the encounter between civilization and the frontier. It is about men's fear of losing their mastery and hence their identity, both of which the Western tirelessly reinvents. Well, you know, people say the Western begins with the Iliad. They say it begins with the Chanson de Roland. They say it begins with captivity narratives in the 17th century. You know, you can really put the beginning anywhere. I mark it at 1902 with the publication of Owen Wister's The Virginian, because that was the first time that a narrative of a man coming into his own and proving his manhood in the American West as a specific historical place entered the mainstream of literary production.
But it's a reaction, is it not, after a fashion?
Yes. My thesis, which I believe to be original, was that the Western was not simply an outgrowth, say, of Cooper's work in The Last of the Mohicans or those dime novels featuring Deadwood Dick robbing a stagecoach, but was specifically arising in opposition to the domination of the culture in the 19th century from about 1820 on by the culture of sentimentalism, which was Christian, evangelical, domestic, and above all, female.
Yeah, it had a lot to do with women.
So The remasculinization of American culture, which was going on across a number of fields at the end of the 19th century, makes itself felt in popular literature in this new genre, which we are so familiar with now, called the Western, which is located in space in the states west of the Mississippi, and in time, usually after the Civil War and before the turn of the century. I believe that the reason for the genres being located there was that it gave men the opportunity to occupy the central position in narratives of external conflict and violence, which established their physical strength as the necessary factor in the survival of civilization.
What about the word death? Why is that important to our understanding the origins of what we call the Western?
Well, I focused on death because as I was reading Westerns, looking for the what I think of as the essential attributes of this narrative, I simply began to notice that the genre is haunted by the imagery of death, by a landscape of aridity and barrenness, which in and of itself suggests the absence of life, by violent conflict, which always ends in one man putting bullets in another man's body, by foreshadowings of these mortal combats in shots of graveyards and cemeteries at the beginning of Westerns, and by the nature of heroism in the genre, which was for a man to prove that he wasn't afraid of exposing himself to being killed.
Are we talking, Jane, about what really happened in history in the Western, or are we talking about the representation of the Western? That is to say, what we in the 20th century feed on and comfort ourselves with, use as symbols or emblems of what we think the West really consisted of? Or, as I say, on the other hand, is it history that you're writing about?
Of course it isn't history that I'm writing about in the sense of, you know, quote, what happened in such and such a time and such a place. It is representation, but it's a representation of a different kind of reality, I would say a social and psychological reality, namely some kind of deeply felt cultural need in the 20th century to reinforce and validate an ethos based on a notion of the necessity for military conflict and for male domination of our society.
All right, now you've talked about death, you've talked about women, you have a section here called Women and the Language of Men, you've mentioned the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
What about horses and cattle? Now, you know, I read your book, I enjoyed it, but I got to challenge you on this one. I really found the argument to run just a little thin there. That is to say, kind of an animal rights tract that you're locating in what we call Western literature? What about this?
Yeah, I somebody sent me a letter the other day in which a man writes, Tompkins's stand on horses and cattle weakens her position on other aspects of the Western.
What do you think?
I've been picked on by critics for this. I think that that just as at one time it was thought quite indelicate and, in fact, inappropriate and a violation of decency to be talking about women and women's rights in relation to literature, just as racism at one time was a topic never dreamed of as being an appropriate part of literary criticism, the absolutely same thing is true about animals now. If I talk about animals in relation to cultural representations, people feel that they are being sermonized at, that they're being taken advantage of, they came to hear criticism, and what are they getting? They're getting animal rights. Well, it's just because we have not yet in our culture extended the boundaries of our awareness to include our relationship to animals and the environment.
Well, let me put it to you this way, Jane. The evidence itself. Tell me about the evidence that's in the books and
right,
the movies.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's not as if I were dragging horses in for no reason. I mean, I was trying to do a phenomenology of the Western, an anatomy of this genre. I was trying to look at those elements without which a Western wasn't a Western.
Right.
And after a while, I kept on seeing horses on the screen. You know, they take up a lot of time. A lot of shots in Western movies, staple shots, are the shots of the posse that, you know, galloping, pounding hooves, galloping across the desert plains, you know, after the bad guys. In fact,
now, let me stop you for a moment. Yeah. The movie that you mentioned that caught my attention was Red River.
Yeah.
Why? What do you do with that title, for example?
Well, in Red River, I shift my focus away from the treatment of horses in Westerns to the treatment of cattle, because once you start looking at horses and trying to figure out what they're doing there, you know, pretty soon you end up wondering about the same thing about cattle. Right. Let me say a word about horses first, if I might. I think that horses are essential in Westerns because they represent what I feel is the basic desire of the genre, and that is to afford us some way to reconnect with a lost sense of life. The horse is a throbbing, vital, powerful body which is alive and full of force, and our connection to nature is through the body of the horse in the Western, which both invites us to merge with nature, just as the landscape invites the hero finally to merge with it in death, and at the same time presents a challenge which the hero tries to dominate, curb, and control, and finally, in some cases, to extinguish.
All right, and the cow, the cattle, on the other hand, would represent what? The commercial, the industrial link, that is to say, the way we tie ourselves to the machinery of our society, the way we make money?
Well, here's how I approach it. I concluded that the hero's relation to the horse, which was often one of domination and control, was an analog of his relation to his own body, which he had to learn to subdue, and to whose impulses he needed to contain, primarily in the way of never showing that he felt pain and being able to sustain it over a long period of time, just the way horses have to sustain a great deal of the cruelty that's meted out to them. Mm-hmm. Well, in the case of cattle, this analogy is made even more extreme and, I must say, horrifying once you look at it. I take the metaphor of the cattle drive, which is the central action of the movie Red River, as well, not metaphorical, but literal at the level of the driving of the bodies of 10,000 cattle thousands of miles to a railhead to be shipped to the slaughterhouses in Chicago. And then I read that back onto the psychological drama of a movie in which one tyrannical man, played by John Wayne, of course, drives first of all himself and his own body. He's injured and sleepless and suffering, but makes himself go on nevertheless, drives the hands who are under his command until finally they mutiny against him because they can't stand it anymore. This determination to reach his goal at all costs, to not let anything stand in the way. His sweetheart is killed. He kills Indians. He kills Mexicans. He kills his own men. He practically kills himself.
Sounds like Captain Ahab.
It is. It is. It's a very. It's not at all. It has parallels. This notion of sort of the domination first of the self and then of others is, I think, emblematized and repeated, paralleled in the driving of the cattle, who I feel are the unconscious of the movie, if you will.
Jane Tompkins, how does the Western come to us in the 1990s? We've got so much material to cover here. Let me just jump forward a little bit. One of your end chapters here, the epilogue, is Fighting Words. Mm-hmm. You write about violence. You also become very personal in the way you plead the case here, this passion that you feel for the way we have inherited and used Westerns in our literature and in our culture. What about it?
Well, that's a multi-leveled question, and I'll answer it in a sort of a three-pronged way.
Give
First
me a
of
Western
all,
sweep.
The Western in the 1990s. Dances with Wolves won the Oscar for Best Movie in 1990. It is a Western, and it is, I believe, a progressive Western, a New Age Western, I would argue. I think that in that movie, although Kevin Costner falls prey to a lot of the old tropes of the Western, enduring pain, suffering and cruelty, lots of violence and so forth, that the basic trajectory of the plot is not towards the shootout at Main Street, is not the, you know, the cattle war or anything like that. It is towards intimacy, towards closeness, towards
harmony,
and learning how to live in happiness, in harmony, in communion with a small group of other people, and especially in this case, men. On the other hand, you have the regressive Western, instantiated by Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven, where, despite, I feel, all of the revisionary moves he makes, all of the irony, you know, all of the satire of the genre, nevertheless, the basic trajectory of the plot, it's the same old thing. We get off on the huge shootout at the end. It's the orgasm of murder and violence that is pulling us in and that is keeping us on as we move through that narrative. So the Western is surprisingly, since it sort of died in the middle 70s, alive and well right now, and is representing both, I think, the more progressive elements of our culture, represented in Dances with Wolves, connected, I think, to the men's movement, and the more regressive, militaristic elements represented by Unforgiven.
You're listening to Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest is Jane Tompkins, a professor of English at Duke University. We're talking about her new book, West of Everything, a new reading of the cultural and social landscape of the American West.
Tell me, as quickly as you can, Jane Tompkins, why do you like the novels of Louis L'Amour? Why do you defend them? Here you are, a full professor at Duke University, and you are standing up and arguing for the literary merit, the aesthetic merit of Louis L'Amour, who is, what, the sports department of literature, traditionally.
Well, that's only a holdover from the sort of high culture snobbery against popular literature. I would put Louis L'Amour up against most writers I know, sentence for sentence and paragraph for paragraph.
He's a good writer.
When he is a terrific writer. I got the title of my book, which is much admired, West of Everything, from a paragraph that appeared in Hondo, his 1953 bestseller, which really put him on the map. I have a lot of objections to Louis L'Amour, as I have a lot of objections to the Western in general, but I think that that L'Amour was a master of narrative suspense, that he knew how to get you right into the middle of a story and to keep you there, and that his sense of the Western landscape, perhaps more than anything, was so acute and so deep, that his artistry as a conveyor of the feelings of the landscape is really not to be matched by anyone that I know who represents the West.
Do we have another Louis L'Amour on the horizon now? I mean, how do we measure up people like Tony Hillerman, that kind of thing? Is that a different category altogether?
Well, I think Tony Hillerman is an interesting example. Tony Hillerman, I would say, represents the sort of New Age Kevin Costner, softer, more progressive use of Western materials.
Kinder, gentler Westerns?
Well, I mean, not to parody it at all.
Right.
I think that it's very important to notice that it's Native Americans now who are providing our culture with the models that it is looking for in order to find a way of living successfully in our environment and peaceably with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So the hero of Dances with Wolves becomes a Lakota Sioux, and in Tony Hillerman's novels, it's the Navajo rituals and ethos that attract readers to these stories by the millions. I mean, he's not really that good of a mystery writer. It's the whole ambience and atmosphere of this Navajo way of life that people just love.
What are your favorites, Jane Tompkins? Have you got a favorite novel and a favorite movie? I know you wrote a fair amount in your book here about Red River, and you've got pictures of John Wayne. What comes to mind?
Yeah, well, Red River is one of my favorites. So is Shane. I just saw it again the other night for about, I don't know how many times I've seen Shane. It stands up. It really holds up.
One-Eyed Jacks, would you put that on your top
like
40 list?
Well, One-Eyed Jacks is sort of an idiosyncratic Western,
sure,
but
is.
I'm a Marlon Brando fan from way back, and I like it a lot, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You think the Western has a future in our fiction and in our popular culture?
It's hard to say. We're undergoing a sort of mini revival of the Western right now, and I expect that it will continue for some period of time. Basically, I feel that the genre that is taking the place of the Western in the popular media is science fiction, and that you can see the same elements that we find in the Western being played out in science fiction.
Well, Star Wars has been called a Western.
Yes, well, I think that it is, and I think that one of the interesting things about this is that it is translating into science fiction in the same bifurcated way that I indicated it's living on now in Dances with Wolves and Unforgiven. In other words, there are what I would consider the progressive science fiction movies like E.T. and to an extent Star Wars, which are groping for a new model for human behavior. In E.T., for instance, it's human love which is going to save our society, not the ability to shoot another man down in cold blood because you're so hardened yourself. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have the continuation of the hard-bitten hero in the Western in figures like Terminator and RoboCop, where the human flesh, which has been mortified and numbed in by the Western hero in order to do his murderous work, actually turns into metal and, you know, synthetic materials in the figures of these sort of half-human, half-machine-like heroes who deal out destruction because they themselves, in effect, have been destroyed.
Jane, let me end on this note. Come back to the personal dimension mm-hmm. for a moment. How does all of this translate itself into your teaching? How does it translate itself into... Well, you told me before our taping that there may seem an unlikely leap between your book here on the Western and the topics that you're interested in now, that is to say, teaching and pedagogy. Bridge that chasm for me quickly, will you?
Well, I feel that the Western afforded... men and women, too, in the first 75 years of this 20th century, a disciplinary model of behavior, which meant that in order to be successful in business, say, or professionally, that a person had to keep their feelings under tight rein and simply keep their eye, on the bottom line or on what would make for success, not caring for their own spiritual, physical, emotional well-being, nor for that of others in the relentless pursuit of a goal. I think that some of these disciplinary aspects of the Western hero are replayed in the classroom in certain authoritarian structures and in the notion, say, in graduate and professional schools that you have to kill yourself with work in order to be a really good student.
Or beat the other guy.
Or to beat the other guy. Thanks for reminding me. The element of competition is central to the academy right from the beginning, but especially the further up you get, college, graduate school, professional school, the more competition comes to the fore and becomes almost the only thing. I'm interested in creating an educational environment which de-emphasizes competition and which emphasizes cooperation and the development of the human individual qualities of each student.
Well, you end your book, West of Everything, Jane Tompkins, talking about the golden rule and violence, and I don't want to accuse you. I'm saying this with a straight face. I'm not accusing you of being maudlin or soft at the core,
oh, yes.
But believe me, it is a very appealing argument here, coming from somebody who is purportedly a hard-bitten, big-shot professor of literature at a big-shot university, to come back to a message as simple and as compassionate as that. Are you going to take a lot of heat because of that from your professional colleagues? Are they going to look at you and say, ah, she's getting to be a softy?
Oh, they probably do say that, although they, of course, don't say it to my face. Well, you know, the reason, what writing this book did for me, Wayne, was that it made me see the extent to which I had introjected the values of the Western hero myself. When I started writing this book, I thought I was writing about men, them, the others, you know, those guys. And I had what I considered a love-hate relationship with the Western hero. I thought I was working through my relationship to men in the book. And indeed, to a certain extent, I was. But by the time I got to the end, I realized I was writing about myself, that I had become inured to my own deepest needs, that I was in many ways playing out, you know, the same codes that the Western hero had been taught, because after all, I had made it in this academic game, which is a really tough competitive game, and I had become a sort of a living example of the things that I was so upset at when I saw them in the Western. And so really this book is kind of a step in a process of trying to undo my own conditioning and to help in by turning now to pedagogy to sort of help other people not fall into some of the same self-destructive patterns that I unknowingly fell into.
Well, Jane, I want to thank you for your eloquent defense of your book. It's a wonderful book, and I want to recommend it to our listeners. It is West of Everything. The subtitle is The Inner Life of Westerns. Jane Tompkins, you're a professor of English at Duke University. Thank you very much for coming by the National Humanities Center, and good luck in your work.
Thank you, Wayne.
Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad. The story of the violence that moved west with young America. The story of a man who moved with it. Matt Dillon, United States Marshal.
You're listening to Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guest was Jane Tompkins, a professor of English at Duke University. Her new book is West of Everything, subtitled The Inner Life of Westerns, published by Oxford University Press. Jane Tompkins is also the author of Sensational Designs, an account of 19th century American fiction. Send $5 for a tape of this show, or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 636. That's number 636, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The center welcomes your comments. Next week, join me for a conversation with the novelist Lawrence Nomoff. We'll talk about his new book entitled Taller Women, a cautionary tale of love in the 1990s. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. West of Everything, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with cultural historian Jane Tompkins of Duke University. We'll talk about her new book, West of Everything, subtitled The Inner Life of Westerns, a rereading of popular stereotypes about the American West. West of Everything, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.